I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Recent Advances in Medical Oncology, as this afternoon we discuss prostate cancer, new developments, what happened at ASCO, and a lot of practical issues in terms of taking care of patients in a medical oncology setting. We're thrilled to have our distinguished faculty with us today, who will not only be discussing the data, but also cases from their practices. Today, we're going to be focusing on prostate cancer and really focusing most of our discussion today on the three common clinical scenarios that medical oncologists often deal with in their practices: M0 disease, hormone-sensitive metastatic disease, and then castrate-resistant disease. And then we're going to talk a little bit about some of the papers that were presented at ASCO. Dan Petrilak's really fascinating oral presentation on ARV-110. The androgen receptor degrader, lutetium, which we've all been interested in for a long time, as well as PSMA imaging. We're going to start out today, and I worked with each of the three faculty individually. We recorded presentations for all three of them on these three topics. We'll let you know when everything's posted, and you can check out their presentations, which go through these topics in detail. But what we did for tonight is just pick out a few of the slides that were presented just so we can capsulize it and then really move on to the issue of how this functions in terms of clinical practice. And we're going to integrate a survey we just did in the last week or so with 50 general medical oncologists in community-based practice. And maybe we can just kind of start out with that, and maybe just to take a step back before we start talking about scenarios. Dan, maybe we can just talk a little bit about M0 disease. In your lecture, you went through the data. We'll talk about that in a second. But just maybe provide a little bit of a broad perspective, Dan, on where we've come from in terms of M0 disease, where we were 3 or 4 years ago, where we are today, and where you see us moving in the future, Dan.
So previously, there was really no standard of care for treatments with M0 prostate cancer. We often tried secondary hormonal manipulations, but there was no FDA-approved treatment. So Matt Smith, a number of years ago, looked at zoledronic acid. He did a retrospective analysis of those patients and found that those patients who had a PSA of greater than 13 and who had a rapid PSA doubling time were the ones who got into trouble the quickest. And about half of those patients from his study developed metastatic disease within 2 years. So the endpoint of metastasis-free survival, which was the endpoint of the apalutamide, enzalutamide, and darolutamide trials, was used for FDA drug approval. And whereas we had no drugs in the past for this indication, now we have three.
So let's talk a little bit about how this is actually playing out in practice. And Chris, you can see this question we ask the panel of 50 oncologists, a 65-year-old patient, has a prostatectomy, PSA only, recurrence, and further progression after, I think, radiation therapy, now with a PSA of 3.4, a doubling time of 10 months. And you can see that the docs in this survey are using anti-androgens. I don't know how exactly, whether it's 100% representative of what's going on in the United States in terms of the choice. But Chris, any thoughts about these answers?
In all honesty, I suspect that might be driven by having a more active marketing project out there for the use of apalutamide. In this situation, it's approved now for this non-metastatic CRPC setting and hormone-sensitive, so people may be interested in trying out a new drug. We know enzalutamide very well from its use in castration-resistant disease. I'm a little bit surprised about darolutamide. That may be a lack of familiarity, because in all honesty, I would be interested to hear if Rob and Dan agree. All three drugs have the same efficacy. They both delay the time to PSA progression, the time to appearance of disease on a scan, and also the side effect profile is possibly less with darolutamide in terms of less fatigue. 10% of patients have trouble with apalutamide or enzalutamide from fatigue and cognitive changes, which we don't see with darolutamide.
Rob, any comments on that? You know, general medical oncology is an incredible challenge nowadays. And we're trying to do CME. We can barely keep up with everything going. It's not that easy to keep up nowadays. It looks like the perception in the general medical oncology community is that the efficacy is about the same. In terms of tolerability, it's interesting. People have sort of different impressions. I don't know whether they get them clinically or from the data. What's your approach to this situation, Rob, in terms of choice of agent?
As my colleagues have said, I mean, the data is the same. If you look at all three papers and you just look at them by themselves without comparison, the bottom line is the darolutamide trial suggested that in the placebo arm, there was not a lot of difference. That's not the case with the other two agents. Therefore, for me, if I'm going to treat a patient in this clinical setting based on level one evidence and my interpretation of the toxicity, darolutamide is what I would use. Abiraterone, despite the fact that it may have utility here, has not been tested here, nor is it approved.
So we're going to dig a little more deeply into this, but we'll also get into some cases. And here's a question that we want to pose to the audience to answer. And this is really based on a case that Dan presented in his session where he recorded his presentation. He presented two cases that we're going to show today. We just want to know from the audience, if you have an 84-year-old patient who's got a history of atrial fibrillation, sick sinus syndrome, pacemaker, and hypertension, and you're going to use hormonal therapy, any preferences as to which one? And while they're sort of thinking about that, in a second we'll look at the case, but Chris, how would you answer that question? Any preferences in terms of choice of agent in this situation?
The first question would be to ask, does he need anything? What's his rate of rise? Because his chance of dying from his comorbidities is substantial. The other issue is dollars to donuts. He's probably taking an anticoagulant, maybe a DOAC, with drug-drug interaction issues. So I would have to be hard-pressed to actually start anything. And if I were to start, it would probably be darolutamide for the less of the cognitive issues, less drug-drug interaction, less frailty-inducing if he needed a therapy.
So, Dan, this actually is based on a case that you presented in your individual session. Can you talk a little bit about what happened with this man? He actually had M0 disease. What happened with him?
So basically, we started him on enzalutamide. He's doing fine right now, had a PSA decline. Interestingly, we did try darolutamide first, but we were denied by the insurance company because they wanted us to try enzalutamide first. Their line was, quote unquote, he had to fail enzalutamide before going on Dara. So he's not on an anticoagulant at this point. He does have sick sinus syndrome. He's got a pacemaker in place. So he's not on any anticoagulant, at least when he came to my care.
That's interesting, though. Putting aside the cardiovascular history, so you had them deny darolutamide for M0 disease. And here we're talking about, you know, what your preference is, and yet it sounds like you weren't able to actually execute that. How's he been doing on the enzalutamide?
He's doing fine. He's doing fine right now.
Great. So, Dan, when you went through the data, I love this slide that you put together. You comment a little bit on it.
So basically what it's showing us, it's comparing apples to bananas. The structure of enzalutamide, in fact, enzalutamide and apalutamide came out of the same laboratory. They're very, very similar. There's a variation on the ring on the middle ring, but pretty much it's the same otherwise. If you look at darolutamide, it's structurally very, very different than the two, and that may account for the reason that we have a different distribution in the central nervous system crossing the blood-brain barrier with these drugs. Apalutamide, 19%, enzalutamide, 29%, whereas darolutamide has only a 3% penetration rate. So that, I think, is a very interesting observation. It may explain some of the toxicities that we've seen.
Anything you want to say about the trial? We've been looking at these for a while now. You put together the first two. Anything you want to say about the data there, Dan?
They're very similar in their hazard ratios as well as their medians. I think what's striking is the control arms are very, very similar as well. So you really can't tell the difference between these two.
Same what about the Aramis study?
Same thing with Aramis. Very similar hazard ratios.
And here's maybe a comparison of the three. Anything you want to say about this, Dan?
Again, the hazard ratios for overall survival at this point are the same. The estimated survivals, there is a difference at this point, the median overall survival. But again, this is estimated. And we now have close to 4 to 5 years of follow-up in these patients.
And here's where it gets really interesting. And you put this together, comparing the toxicities, Dan.
Again, enzalutamide has higher rates of fatigue, falling, dizziness, and mental impairment than darolutamide does. And certainly this could be a differentiating factor between these drugs.
So, Rob, can you comment a little bit more about sort of, you know, it's one thing to look at clinical trial data and see, try to the evaluation of toxicity, but what you actually see in your clinical practice, and maybe talk a little bit about what's been called fatigue, but maybe is more of a central nervous system syndrome that you see with these agents.
Yeah, you know, all of us have used these drugs a lot, and what you see is there's fatigue, and then the patients who complain of, you know, I forgot how to get home. But the fall and fracture rates are surrogates for this. Patients who lose their balance and have fractures. And as our patients get older and the sarcopenia that's associated with some of these therapies, those are real issues. So to me, when those of us who know this data, we look at the fall and fracture rate as a true surrogate of harm for the cognitive issues. And in the darolutamide trial, you see less of that. And since, you know, our patients are 60, 70, 80 years old, this is a real issue.
Chris, any comments on that? And again, in terms of clinically in your experience, what you see with patients, and this is not just an issue in M0 disease, obviously, but can you talk a little bit more about, again, this sort of syndrome of, quote, fatigue that you see in the pathophysiology of it?
Two things, yes. So there's obviously, it would appear to be something crossing the blood-brain barrier. Interestingly enough, we know the drug enzalutamide and apalutamide were both designed off the back of benzodiazepine-like structures. So there is some GABA reactions. And we know they also have this rare incidence of seizure. So there's some pathophysiology and molecular biology that makes sense. Interestingly enough, I've just saw some data hot off the press today. We've presented the results of the quality of life from the EnzaMet study. And the specific question I've asked is, how many patients on enzalutamide have a 10% drop? Some people have a mild drop in their quality of life and their fatigue and their cognition, but it is actually 10% who have a clinically significant decline, which plays out as a subtle overall impairment for everyone as a group. But it's a 10% who drive that subtle difference between placebo versus drug.
It's really interesting. And also, I never heard about the connection to benzodiazepine. That's really interesting. So Dan has another case that gets into a different issue in terms of M0 disease that we haven't really talked about as much. But the more I listen to Dan talk about this case, the more I realize how important it is. And to get into that, we have another question that we want to put out to the audience here, which is, what systemic treatment, if any, would you add on to an LHRH agonist in a 74-year-old man with M0 disease who has disease progression but still negative imaging while receiving enzalutamide? So as a patient with castrate-resistant disease, M0 gets enzalutamide, responds to it, but now the PSA is going back up, but still no evidence of metastatic disease, and we'll see how the audience in general thinks that through. Rob, any comment in general about this sort of space, so to speak? How do, in general, the audience is split between not adding anything, not doing anything, and then maybe trying another form of hormonal therapy. 20% of people say docetaxel in the M0 setting, which I don't know about that, but Rob, any comments?
One of the things that worries me and my colleagues is that we're treating patients. Remember, some of these patients got hormonal therapy for biochemical failure who may not have needed hormonal therapy. So if you treat enough of those patients, you're going to make castrate-resistant PSA-only disease. And then if you treat them, they're going to progress. So here's a guy who, you know, probably conventional imaging, maybe if you use next-generation imaging, you find disease. I think we need to be thoughtful about how much we treat a parameter PSA and how much we're treating, you know, the underlying disease and how much we're treating ourselves. I think there's a real danger to that. This is a data-free zone, and I think we just need to be careful about this.
Well, let's see how this plays out in real life with Dan's patient, a 74-year-old man. And so Dan, he presented, I guess, initially in 2007. Can you talk a little bit about this case, Dan?
So he had a radical prostatectomy at that time. He had T2CN0 disease. I'll go on to the next slide. He started to have a rise in PSA in 2013. I couldn't treat him with salvage radiation therapy at that time due to the fact he had severe incontinence. And we monitored him until his PSA went up to 12, and he wanted to start hormone therapy at that point. So he started Degarelix, and he was treated intermittently, basically for the next 4 years. And his PSA started doubling rapidly early in 2018. We put him back on androgen blockade at that point. His PSA was 18, and he did not respond to androgen blockade at that point. His testosterone was 20. So we imaged him. He was negative, and he went on enzalutamide when his PSA reached 26. And his PSA doubling time at that point was 8 months. And his PSA nadired at 4 in October of 2018. And then January of 2019, it started rising again. We imaged him again, found nothing. Actually, we think we imaged him twice during the next 8 or 9 months, and both of those imagings were negative. But he was concerned about his PSA rise, and he reached 71 in December, and he said, look, I don't want to continue on with enzalutamide. Through the VA, we were able to get him apalutamide, and his PSA continued to rise. Reached about 240 in February of 2020, and we reimaged him at that point again. At that point, he had metastatic disease in bone, and he's on docetaxel. He's actually responding very, very nicely at this point.
And you told me that he actually was becoming symptomatic with pain, and that
correct.
Responded.
That responded that response. Nicely.
So, Rob, I know you're very conservative about managing these patients. You already mentioned that, but when I look at this case, I go, you know, if you think about it, you know, in December, he was clearly progressing. A lot of the audience suggested trying another hormone. I'm curious to know, Rob, whether you think that has any possibility of benefiting. But then 3 months later, he was on the docetaxel, and then he's symptomatic. So, I mean, if you want to do Monday morning quarterbacking, I'd say maybe it would have been better to start the docetaxel earlier. But, of course, I don't think we have the data. But just in general, Rob, any comments about this scenario?
I think this is a case that, you know, in a year, maybe when we have PSMA PET more broadly available, Dr. Petrylak would have, you know, he knew that the patient had metastatic disease. He just couldn't prove it, right? So it'll move leftward where we are, especially in a patient like this. And this wasn't the patient I was really referring to. It's more of a patient that, you know, may have a very prolonged PSA doubling time, and it's more about chasing numbers as opposed to bad disease biology.
So again, would you use a second hormonal therapy, Rob, in this situation? What would you do in that situation? Again, looking in retrospect at December.
You know, there obviously is no right answer. And, you know, I probably wouldn't have been inclined to do so because I would have thought that the cross resistance to the drugs was such that it'd be a problem. You know, as Dr. Petrylak, I know, did is he was telling the patient, look, you probably have, you know, we would now say we might find oligometastatic disease at some point with these patients. So I think this is the kind of patient whose management is going to change a fair amount over the next bit because of just better imaging.
That's really interesting. Looking for oligometastatic disease, you know, that maybe you'd be able to treat locally, I guess. Chris, any thoughts about this scenario? Have you ever seen a response in a patient who's progressing on one antiandrogen to the next one? How do you manage these patients?
There are two thoughts on that. One is I would start with encouraging this patient, saying, yes, your PSA is going up, and we're going to watch this closely, not necessarily need to change from an AMIDE to an AMIDE, but we will watch you and we'll do scans and we will switch therapy when we need to. The PSA is telling us we need to watch you more closely and try and engage them in that and try and address their fears that way. The second issue is I have seen patients respond well to an amide after abiraterone. And that's a patient who's been on abiraterone for 2 years, 3 years, lymph node only. You switch them over, they get another 18 months on the amide. I've not seen patients really benefit from amide to abiraterone. So the hormone switch does work in a minority of patients who have got good, long, durable responses to abiraterone in some of them. So you can try a switch, but you've got to watch them closely, knowing when to change them over. And one of the questions in the chat is about ARV7. We know who are the ARV7 patients without testing. They're the ones with rapid progression, newly progressive disease on an amide. The patients who have a slow progression on abiraterone, lymph nodes slightly larger, PSA going up, they're ARV7 negative. So I use clinical parameters rather than ARV7 testing.
So we're going to move on now and talk about hormone-sensitive metastatic disease. And I hear a lot of investigators telling me that this strategy that we're talking about today of adding something to ADT is not done as much as it should be in practice. But I find that surprising because maybe it's the oncologist we're dealing with, because you'll see every time you ask people, they kind of give the right answer. So anyhow, I'm just kind of curious whether that accusation, so to speak, is actually really true. But I refer you to Chris's Talmudic talk going through so many different aspects of this. Really fascinating. We're just going to pick out a couple of points that Chris has made, but I really recommend you check out the talk. So here's, sort of the introduction to this, Dan. A patient who's had a radical prostatectomy presents 3 years later with three asymptomatic bone mets that are not amenable to ablative therapy. So first of all, it looks like the audience in general is on board, certainly, to do something in addition to ADT. And you can see their preferences, and mainly anti-androgens. Interestingly, also a little bit of chemotherapy in this sort of lower risk situation. Rob, any comments about this scenario and these answers?
I would point out that I think you attract a subset of really pretty sophisticated folks. Yeah. And I think in the real world,
this is random, dude. Random
smart people, because
random people.
Yeah, my colleagues would agree. We see not in significant numbers of patients who are either don't have the conversation. And I think part of it's because you're also querying mostly medical oncologists. And
right. This was medical oncologists. Right. You think it's the urologist?
Well, in fairness, there are folks who manage metastatic prostate cancer to start with hormonal therapy, who are urologists. And, perhaps the uptake of that data is a little less sophisticated in some groups. I mean, I don't want to throw stones, but I think it's a real phenomenon. And I think what you see there is what we see in practice, is that abiraterone is broadly used and the other agents are data-driven. I don't really think there are too many patients that should not get additive therapy. I mean, so today, essentially all patients should, with really few exceptions.
So we'll talk about that and some of the exceptions that maybe could be considerations. Dan, any comments? Also, another strategy not too many people use, but you see 10-15% of people doing, is starting out with just ADT, see how the patient does, and then if they don't have a great response, adding something in. Any comment on that, Dan? And also how you approach the choice between chemotherapy and endocrine therapy in this situation, Dan?
So I think those patients who... if you're going to take that approach, you have a limited time frame. The trials that have implemented chemotherapy and AD and the next generation agents do that within 3 months of starting treatment. And my feeling is try to do it early. Drugs like apalutamide, enzalutamide, if you're having trouble tolerating, you discontinue it. I'd rather see the benefit given up front. In choosing agents, I try to select them based upon potential side effect patterns and also the extent of disease. I do use chemotherapy for the high-risk, high-volume patients. Also for those patients who may have de novo prostate cancer as opposed to somebody who was diagnosed with localized disease first, who may be rapidly progressive, younger patients, high Gleason score, Gleason 9, Gleason 10. That, I think, is somebody who's going to get into trouble fairly rapidly. As far as choosing between the different hormonal agents, I used to use a lot of abiraterone. I've been shying away from that based upon some cardiovascular effects I've seen and some people have been completely asymptomatic. And if we look at the data that was presented last year by the Fox Chase group, there's actually a much, much higher than expected rate of cardiovascular events in patients who are treated with abiraterone and prednisone. Remember that the original trials excluded those patients with significant cardiovascular disease. So we've got to be wary of that fact in the our patients and how we select our drugs.
And what's the presumed mechanism of increased cardiovascular risk with abiraterone, Dan?
I think it's threefold. Firstly, you have hypertension, which can develop. Secondly, fluid retention. So if somebody's got a borderline ejection fraction, they may not handle the extra fluid load as well. And there can be a direct cardiac effect of the drug on the myocardium.
So Chris, in your talk, you go through in detail a bunch of concepts that I think are really interesting, but there are two in particular that really struck me. First, let's just take a look at a couple other scenarios we presented to the same group. So now we're saying the patient has widespread, moderately symptomatic disease, a lot more docetaxel. We say their liver mets, a lot more docetaxel. And then, Chris, in your talk, you went through the key trials that sort of were the groundwork for looking at these issues. But what I really wanted to focus on is your interpretation of them. And what really came across as, you know, you were doing this presentation was kind of what Dan just alluded to, not only factoring in volume, but the other factor that you mentioned that kind of hadn't been on my radar enough was, again, de novo versus recurrent or asynchronous. Chris, rather than going through all the details on the slides, maybe you could just conceptually talk about how you think through these variables and how it translates into what you do in practice, Chris.
So I think it's your clinical intuition on a patient. So if someone presents with a PSA of 50 right out of the gate, you check a scan and he's got multiple bone metastases. This is the de novo high volume, and we know their median survival is 3 years. They do poorly in general. If that same person presents with two bone metastases, the lower burden but still de novo, their outlook is 4.5 years. So some of them do well, some of them do poorly. So the de novo low volume is a bit of a watershed. And then the patient you presented first, late relapse, has low volume, has a median survival of 8 years from the start of the hormones alone. So you can really start to get a feel for what the trajectory is, what the rapidity of its presentation is. And we're much more familiar with cytotoxics for visceral crisis for breast cancer. And so recognizing you've got a general medical oncology audience, I liken it to that. It's you need to get more urgent control and get the chemotherapy out of the way. So think of it like how we think visceral crisis breast cancer as opposed to indolent bone-only breast cancer as an analogy.
That is a good analogy. And you had you showed a slide that I'm going to show in a second, but first I want to ask the audience a couple more questions related to your slide. So two scenarios for the audience. You've got a younger patient, no comorbidities, de novo metastatic, high volume disease. Okay, so generally, how would you approach that patient? And Chris, I'll ask you, in general, how would you approach a patient like that? And then I'm going to ask Rob.
Generally, I sit down with them and say, you're chemo fit, and you have all of these are your options except darolutamide. Darolutamide is not approved and not available in this setting yet. ADT alone, I do not think is the right answer. You can go docetaxel, get him to a remission, hold, just continue the hormones, and then add on the new hormones later. Or you can add in the potent hormones with it and then add docetaxel later. By getting the docetaxel in, you're getting it in and out of the way when they're fittest. They can have a treatment break with just the castration alone, the testosterone suppression. So I actually have the patient help me make the decision. I don't make it for them. I give them the pros and cons.
Rob, any thoughts on
my approach is very similar to Dr. Sweeney's. I think that's exactly spot on.
So here's the other end, older patient, congestive heart failure, coronary artery disease, two asymptomatic biopsy proven rib mets. So I'm going to ask Dan in a second how we think this through. Would you add anything onto ADT? What would you do with a patient like that? Dan, can you talk a little bit about how you approach situations like that?
So this is not somebody I would give chemotherapy to. He's got two asymptomatic bone mets. I would give him ADT plus apalutamide. I think that that's the reason why I would stay away from abiraterone because of his cardiovascular disease. So either apalutamide or enzalutamide. I prefer apalutamide in this situation. I think it's a little better tolerated. If darolutamide were available, as Chris said before, I think that probably would be the best choice given the fatigue issues. But right now, I would go with apalutamide.
You always see a little darolutamide sneaking in there, but I don't think you can even get it paid for. Chris, what about this situation? Would you consider not adding anything to ADT?
Depends how poorly he is. Recognizing his median survival with ADT alone is 8 years, and his median survival from his age and comorbidities is probably a lot less. I've started ADT alone, see how they tolerate that as the first instance, have them come back in 3 months. And I've actually radiated a few of them, their bony metastases, and just said, let's just see how you go with that. And if their PSA gets to less than 0.2, I just continue with the ADT alone. So this is the rare patient where I would go with less, maybe more, and a risk-adapted approach. If they're not getting a good response, then I would add in one of the more advanced hormones.
So there were a couple of sort of slides that you had that sort of summarized some of your thoughts, Chris, about approaching hormone-sensitive prostate cancer. Again, I really recommend you check out the talk, but can you just comment on this slide, Chris, and kind of distill a little bit more about how you think through this decision?
So I'll walk through this. So I think it's the patient walks in your room. First question, are they fit for chemotherapy? Yes or no? That helps you know, is docetaxel on the table at all? What's the extent of their disease? We've got very consistent evidence of benefit with the hormones in the low volume and the high volume and metachronous and de novo. So that covers the waterfront. Whereas the docetaxel, the signals are mixed. There's absolutely no benefit seen in the subgroups with the metachronous low volume, mixed signals with the de novo low volume, speaking again to them being a hybrid of patients and their disease. So are they fit for chemotherapy? And then start choosing between the hormones versus the other, and also choosing the abiraterone versus the amide based on seizure and blood sugars, as Dan described earlier.
So just to finish this out, Chris, I would like you to talk about your 66-year-old patient initially diagnosed in 2010. Pretty interesting and different case.
It is, yes. So this is a patient who came in and he was a pilot for one of the major airlines doing transatlantic flights, and wonderful personality. And he came in with this discomfort in his pubic bone, high volume Gleason 8 on a biopsy, got a nasty lesion there. We treated him with hormones and radiation. And I said, you know what, I reckon this is relatively isolated way. Maybe we can give some really decent radiation to the prostate and the bone met. Stopped the therapy after 2 years and said, let's see how you go. And lo and behold, 10 years later, he is basically still in a complete remission of sorts. But his testosterone is declining with age, and he's still in a great remission. So there are some patients who are extreme responders who can come off of hormonal therapy, and there's this whole new conversation about, is there a role for radiation to oligometastatic lesions? And I'd like to not use the term cure because I'm not sure, but long-term event-free survival with PSA normal and testosterone recovery, and see if they have a better quality of life.
Now, this is a situation that maybe we should have more, exposure to, more people aware of, Dan, in terms of oligometastatic disease. I mean, this is a theme in oncology in general. You hear more and more about, but I don't know that there's enough awareness about this. Any comments, Dan?
Well, I have several patients in our practice just like this where they have had documented metastatic disease, 2 or 3 metastases. We've treated them with abiraterone, radiation therapy to those particular spots, and then 2 years out, we reimage them. They have no visible disease on scans. I've actually had counseled the patients in that situation have stopped their androgen blockade, And we've actually been had a couple of patients whose testosterone's returned to normal and have not had, at this point, any disease yet. That's non-standard treatment. But the question is, what do you do about these patients, particularly if they're young men, and you're going to be subjecting them to the long-term side effects of ADT? Those, you know, if you're looking at treating these people for 10 years, for example, that's going to have significant effects on their bone health, their cardiovascular health. So I think we really need a good series to really evaluate what the role is of stopping treatment if they have been treated for oligomets and then they have nothing left.
Have you stopped patients, Dan?
Yes. Again, with the caveat that this is non-standard, that you know, they've actually told me they're refusing therapy at that point. But we've made a mutual decision to stop and then to observe them.
So interesting. So we're going to now move on and talk about castrate-resistant metastatic disease and also hear another case from the faculty. These are the issues we want to talk about fairly briefly. But let's take a look at some of the poll questions. So, Rob, we have a patient who's getting androgen deprivation or M0 disease, found to have asymptomatic bone mets. So we've been asking this question for a while. And not too much CYP-T in this situation. But Rob, how do you approach a patient like that?
Well, I mean, as you point out, I would probably think about CYP-T since my center is a CYP-T place. But aside from that, you know, most of the time in my practice, if a patient has bone metastases, you know, he needs to be treated. I think the issue that my colleagues have raised is, you know, is this an oligometastatic patient? Are we going to be doing other things? But conventionally, for castrate-resistant metastatic disease, I would think about abiraterone and prednisone. I think it's the best tolerated therapy. So while I would probably offer him CYP-T, if I'm going to use an AR drug, it'll be abiraterone.
I really like Chris's term in his talk of polymetastatic. That kind of reminds us to think about oligometastatic, I think. Dan, here's another situation, which I think the answers are kind of interesting, too. Now we're saying that the patient has moderately symptomatic disease. And, you know, of course, there's a lot of individuality. You know, we can make the patient have a little more pain and they might, you know, people might think differently. So it's not rocket science here. We're just kind of getting people's impressions. But I do find it interesting that in spite of the fact that the patient's moderately symptomatic, most of the people in the survey still would stick with hormones. How do you think that through, Dan?
Well, you can get significant pain relief with abiraterone as well as enzalutamide. So, I mean, my experience is the pain relief is probably better with docetaxel, more rapid. Certainly, you don't see pain relief with CYP-T, and we don't give CYP-T to those patients who are symptomatic. But all of these drugs do have a pain effect.
Getting back to Rob's point about CYP-T, Chris, are you using CYP-T? How you believe in it, so to speak?
I do. I do use it. Do I believe in it? I want to believe in it. The question is, with all the new therapies, is the survival effect actually washed out with the abiraterone, the enzalutamide, the docetaxel, the radium, which we may not see anymore? Having said that, I do use it because there is data to support it, and I use it in the patient who doesn't need another therapy. So the asymptomatic patient, you've got some time. And we actually do have some data from Dana-Farber, for whatever it's worth. The more patients who can get more therapies in, the longer they live. Mm-hmm. And so I sequence through all of them, and whether that's biology or the actual therapies. But patients... we see that we're now having 20% five-year survival rates, 25, with all these new therapies in Dana-Farber registry, whereas before 2010, we were only up around 10%. So we've moved a few patients up out to the 5 years, and I think we see that clinically. Is that great clinical data? No. Is it some encouragement that we're making some real advances? Yes. Are all these therapies additive on top of each other? Heck no.
So, Rob, here's an interesting one. We said you have a patient who's got asymptomatic liver mets, and still you see the majority of people going with hormonal therapy. Any comments?
Probably not my choice. I mean, liver metastases and prostate cancer tends to sort of not end well, and obviously we're going to talk a little bit about genomics and whether or not this patient may be a DDR mutant patient. But the alternative is also the neuroendocrine phenotype. I'm likely to use systemic therapy, and I may think about a platinum-based regimen on top of docetaxel. That would typically be my approach. There's less AR biology going on here typically, and I worry about that patient.
So here's another scenario. And Dan, this is a 65-year-old patient, minimally symptomatic disease, who's gotten docetaxel, ADT, and enzalutamide, but still has disease progression. So sort of the CAR-D type situation that I'm going to ask Rob to comment on. So most of the audience is saying cabazitaxel. Dan, any comments?
Yeah, I would agree with that. This is this patient does not have a DNA repair mutation. I don't think further hormonal therapy will be that effective in this patient. I think cabazitaxel is a reasonable choice.
Do you take into consideration ARV7, for example? Somebody else ordered it, Dan?
Well, as Chris said before, I don't. I've seen some very strange results with ARV7 that have popped up because we're doing next generation sequencing and we see it in some of our specimens, but it hasn't correlated. You generally know that those patients who are sick, and there was a trial that was done a while ago with a drug called glitterone, where they tried to get asymptomatic ARV7 positive patients on it and they couldn't find them. So it's an indicator as to how rapidly the disease is progressing.
So, Rob, you went through the CAR-D trial in your talk. I pulled a couple slides out for you to just comment on. Clearly, it was practice-changing, as you can just see. Can you comment on what they looked at there, Rob?
So, we've known, as you heard Dr. Sweeney mention before, that there is cross-resistance between Abby and Enza, and we've known that for some time. This is one of the prospective studies that pretty much prove it, basically. This is a pretty heavily treated group of patients, either receiving Abby or Enza, most also receiving docetaxel, who've progressed within the year of receiving docetaxel, so bad biology. And then they were randomized to get the alternative AR drug versus cabazitaxel, and there was a survival benefit. There's other data that's prospective, but this is a sort of a definitive study, not so much to tell us that you have to use cabazitaxel here, more to tell us that switching to the alternative agent in patients with bad disease is not a good strategy.
So I'm not sure, when you went through this, I was noting, what you just said about the idea that these people progress within a year, which is, I don't even know that that's typical. And I'm not sure that's on everybody's radar. So Dan, any thoughts about that? And do you approach the patient differently if they were, progressed after 2 years?
Well, yeah, I think Chris pointed that out before. There are these patients who do respond to multiple hormonal manipulations. They tend to have a long duration of response to their initial therapy. So the patient who may be on abiraterone for 3 years, as opposed to somebody who's on it for less than a year, it's different biologically. They may respond again to another hormonal agent. There's not a lot of data on that, but there's a lot of anecdotal stories that all of us have shared in that situation. I've had a couple of patients who've been on 5 hormonal manipulations over an 8 or 9 year period. And they've done well. Eventually they do progress, but I was able to get fairly good mileage out of that. The question is biologically what's different.
I just think we need to emphasize more that point in our CME because I didn't realize that. That's really, really important. So we got a great case here. When I saw the case, I was just trying to think what actually Rob did with this patient. It turns out to be pretty interesting. So Rob, let's hear about the 72-year-old man.
Sure. 5 years out from a Gleason 7, he got salvage radiotherapy for a detectable PSA about a year out, eventually progresses, develops bone metastases, and then started on abiraterone. He has actually a reasonably nice response for 18 months and now is progressing and he's got bone pain. His performance status is good. He has no actionable mutations.
So let me just turn to Chris. How would you be, this is certainly a common situation. How would you be thinking through this one?
So he's fit. And I think the answer is reach for chemotherapy sooner rather than later from what I could see there.
So did he have a docetaxel at that point? I don't think so. But you'd be thinking about chemotherapy?
Yeah, so he What's his status of disease? So he's now, is he castration resistant? That's what I'm not piecing together here. So
yes, he's castrate resistant.
So he's progressed on ADT and abiraterone, has been on it for 18 months.
Only bone disease.
Bone-only disease. So radium definitely has a role here as well. And that's the thing is to, when can you layer in the radium? And so this is probably the patient you can get it in. You don't want to wait too late. Chemotherapy, you can get some debulking with the symptomatic patient is the one that Dan described earlier, Dr. Petrelak. So this is the one chap I would think about sneaking in radium sandwiched between the hormone and the docetaxel. There's one thing thought there that we haven't talked about, how to sneak that in.
Dan, are you up for sneaking some radium in?
You could sneak some radium in. I don't think it's unreasonable. One thing I've tried in these patients who've progressed on abiraterone is we will switch steroids. So I've switched from prednisone to dexamethasone. I've gotten some mileage out of that in some patients, 20% maybe. There's some publications by Dr. Attard on that where they've done that in fairly number, 45 or 50 patients. But that's one thing I would also consider in this patient.
Oh, that's neat. I haven't heard of that one. So, Rob, let's talk about what happened. Kind of interesting.
So here is your sort of evidence radiographically of progression. And again, it's hard on a slide. I mean, the gentleman basically is highly functional. He's got a little pain, but it's being managed with minimal doses of non-steroidals.
And, so go for it, guy. Tell him what happened.
This is the patient that I think that, you know, radium was actually quite useful for, and that's what I opted to give him. Dr. Sweeney has trained me well, so, he tolerated, and I think it's important, as my colleagues have sort of inferred, the radium 223 wasn't approved as a pain drug. It's actually not documented to be a pain drug. It's a drug to improve survival and probably impact on symptomatic skeletal events. And I think radium is underutilized. It's very well tolerated. There are some patients who get symptomatic benefit, not very many, but some do. This patient actually happened to get, he felt better and his PSA dropped for a few months. And the other thing that most of us do is in between cycle 3 and 4, I tend to do CT scans to just make sure that there's not visceral progression, especially in patients who typically have PSA progression.
That's a really interesting situation. And he tolerated treatment well, no cytopenias. You ever see cytopenias with radium?
Maybe, one out of 75 patients, you see a little bit of mild anemia and white count. It really is very well tolerated. Most of the side effects are GI, some diarrhea, some, the ooks a little bit, but really it's an incredibly well tolerated therapy. The key is, and it's easy for the academics. We coordinate very closely with our nuclear med docs or rad oncs, whoever is administering it. But you've got to see the patient monthly, because there are patients who will progress on this therapy. And you can't, with all due respect, have our nuclear medicine colleagues think that they're going to manage castrate-resistant disease. So you really need to see the patient monthly as the patient gets treated.
And so I think they may be even seeing them more now with lutetium maybe coming on board. One final comment, Chris, going back to radium in terms of the issue of combining it with hormonal therapy. We've been kind of going back and forth about that, the issue of bone protection and how important that is if you're going to combine it. There have been a couple of papers we put in the slide deck looking at patterns of care in the community, and there is a lot of, at least this was going on before the recent papers came out, there was a lot of combining endocrine therapy with radium 223. Where are we today with that, Chris? And where do you think that's heading?
Don't do it. I'll say that as the very pithy way. Beautiful idea, destroyed by brutal facts. The combination was worse. Whether that can be salvaged by giving bone protection with zoledronic acid or denosumab, unknown. But there was more pain, progression of bone fractures when you put the abiraterone with the radium. It got a little bit better for the patients who had the bone protection. Same with enzalutamide, but we've got no evidence that there's a synergy or additive benefit of the doublet. So I'm very confident I use them sequentially. Could it be the hormonal therapies are so effective, they actually decrease the osteoblastosis, they decrease the radium distribution to the bone. We don't know. We thought it was going to be better on the cancer. We don't see it. Don't do it. Let's find out. Let's get real data before we do anything.
How about radium and CYP-T, Chris?
If we want to send the country broke, that's one strategy. I don't think so. The one strategy that I think is a nice clinical trial is CTLA-4 inhibition with sipuleucel T is a trial that's being done to see if you can boost the immune system. I don't think radium is going to have enough of an abscopal effect to boost the immune system. I think that's a bit of a beautiful biological theory yet to be proven. But I would say CYP-T alone, and I wouldn't put other agents with it because that may alter the immune system that's being activated if the CYP-T does have a benefit. And again, I want to believe.
So continuing on in terms of castrate-resistant metastatic disease, Dan, we recently did a roundtable. We spent an hour and a half talking about PARP inhibitors and prostate cancer. I'll just ask you for a very brief comment. Everybody's aware, you know, the fascinating data and approvals. Dan, just maybe a summary a little bit in terms of clinical practice, how it's affected the way you approach genomic evaluation of men with metastatic disease and where you're using PARP inhibitors and which one.
So right now, all of our patients who come in to see us at Yale are molecularly phenotyped. It's part of our standard. Just as a standard practice and care, they should be having DNA repair checked, BRCA mutations, ATM. They should also have microsatellite instability checked because there are patients who do respond to pembrolizumab with that particular mutation. So both olaparib as well as rucaparib are approved. They're slightly different indications. Olaparib is for those patients who failed next generation AVI or ENZA plus androgen blockade. Rucaparib is a little bit more down the line after docetaxel and a next generation agent. Both of these drugs in my hands have been very similar in their side effects and their efficacy. So really the only way to select one versus the other is the indication in my mind.
So Rob, I didn't show that we asked that also in the survey what kind of genomic evaluation people are doing for castrate-resistant prostate disease in practice. And pretty much you see NGS and germline panel. Ideally, Rob, is that the best way to approach it or maybe overkill?
No, I don't think it's overkill. I think, as my colleagues have indicated, I think the standard of care has evolved. We need to do germline and somatic testing. You know, on the somatic side, prostate cancer is a bone tropic disease. If you have a prostatectomy specimen from 9 years ago and nothing else, how good is that? I increasingly rely on liquid biopsies. I understand that, you know, there are controversies and issues. But I think from a practical matter, ultimately, we're going to need to use liquid biopsies in prostate cancer. If you have fresh tissue, wonderful, and that should be sent off for somatic. So germline and somatic mutation in any patient with metastatic disease.
So we're going to finish out here with a little bit of a tasting menu of things for the future. And I want to start out with this really fascinating concept. Dan, we're seeing this in multiple diseases. The idea of combining checkpoint inhibitors with anti-angiogenic, you know, renal cell cancer up front, endometrial cancer, both MSI stable and MSI high. Well, actually MSI stable is where you see this combination strategy. And we haven't seen too much with checkpoint inhibitors in prostate cancer other than MSI high. You might want to comment on CDK11/12, Dan. But this paper looks pretty interesting, employing a similar concept using atezo and cabozantinib. Any comments?
So this is one situation where 0 plus 0 equals 30. Cabozantinib has a very, very low response rate. I think in the randomized trials is about 5%. And we just submitted a paper, actually had a paper accepted that I had a presentation at ASCO GU actually a couple of years ago looking at atezolizumab having a less than 10% response rate. So, you know, the thought of an agent such as cabozantinib where it may have an effect on Treg cells, showing this response rate in patients with soft tissue lesions, some patients had liver mets, I think is extremely exciting and needs further confirmation in randomized trials.
So, Rob, you know, common situation with solid tumors in general is a patient with advanced disease. They go through all approved therapies. There's not there's no trial available, and everybody brings up the issue of a checkpoint inhibitor. Would you consider, I mean, these drugs are both approved. Would you, if you could get it paid for, would you try this in a patient, Rob, who had no other options? Or would you use checkpoint inhibitors in general in that situation, Rob?
So outside of MSI high, you know, no, I wouldn't use a checkpoint just to give a checkpoint. I happen to be involved in this study. So, I mean, I'm interested in the combination. The study is pretty much closed. So the next patient who walks in the door, am I going to use cabo atezo? No, I'm not. I mean, I've been doing this a long time. And while I'm very intrigued by this data and I'd love to see this work out, I'm not smarter than randomized trials. And this is not a benign treatment. So forget about the economic issues. I mean, you know, treating people with, you know, I remind my fellows all the time, our patients are not kitchen sinks. This isn't about throwing everything in and just sort of jostling it around and see what works. So we have to be a little bit more thoughtful.
Well, let me challenge you a little bit on that one. Did you see any patients in the trial who had good responses, Rob, clinically?
In fact, I have seen some pretty dramatic responses.
Pretty dramatic responses. You want to see a randomized trial, really?
You know, Neil, having done phase one trials for a long time, you know what the phase one trial Bible tells you? The first patient always responds.
Okay. All right. Well, I won't push you too much on that. But anyhow, let's go. We want to pick up a couple of papers presented at ASCO. And this first one that Dan presented, I really recommend you check out the oral. Just go to the ASCO virtual meeting. It is really an awesome presentation. ARV-110, a protein degrader. Dan, can you just kind of talk a little bit? I love the graphics you presented there.
So this
talk
is
about what this is. ProTac. So
this is a drug that was developed by Craig Cruz at Yale. It is an orally bioavailable PROTAC. What a PROTAC is, it's a molecule that will bind to a particular protein and accelerate its degradation through the E3 ubiquitin ligase pathway. And one of these PROTAC molecules can actually degrade up to 400 target proteins. So in this case, we took the androgen receptor, and this particular PROTAC will degrade everything except ARV7, and there's also a second mutation that is non-degradable as well. So there are two mutations that are not degraded. We did a standard phase one trial. We were able to show that there was downregulation of the androgen receptor. This was a patient who was treated at 280 milligrams 6 weeks after treatment. Those are repeat biopsies. You can see on the right, there is less expression of the androgen receptor in the tissue. And in those patients who had actionable mutations, or at least degradable mutations, and also above 140 milligrams. And this was the dose that we felt was the magic dose, above which is where, in the correlating with the laboratory, we had activity. We had two patients, both of whom had a T878A/H878Y mutation, which is associated with both abiraterone and enzalutamide resistance. Both of these patients had PSA declines, and one of these patients had a objective soft tissue response. As you can see, that's almost complete resolution of that node, and his IVC, which has collapsed, is now patent. And that patient had a 97% reduction in PSA. So it's exciting. It's preliminary, and I will stress preliminary. We've got a lot of work to do to figure out exactly who's the right patient, and of course, whether we've got broader activity in other mutations as well. So I think that, you know, small numbers, very small numbers, but a first target, first way of targeting a protein with the PROTAC.
So I was joking with Dan that this is prostate cancer's answer to fulvestrant and breast cancer. I know it's different, but the idea of getting rid of the receptor. Just finally,
there is a PROTAC that's being raised against estrogen. That's in clinical trials right now.
Awesome. So getting back to the other issue in terms of the lutetium PSMA, Rob, there's actually a randomized trial, and we've been hearing about this strategy for so long. It was in Europe for a while. Is this coming to the U.S.? Maybe you can just talk briefly about what this is, Rob, and what they presented there at ASCO.
Sure. Prostate-specific membrane antigen has been a target because it's pretty ubiquitous in prostate cancer. So for 25, 30 years, there have been diagnostic attempts and therapeutic attempts. This is a small molecule that targets PSMA and releases lutetium, which is a beta emitter. As you point out, there's data from colleagues in Australia and in Germany, which demonstrate anti-tumor activity and a relatively reasonable safety profile, although the data is very, very preliminary. You referred to the phase 3 registration trial, which is referred to as VISION, and that study has been completed, and I think many of us think we may see data later this year. There was a randomized phase 2 presented at ASCO comparing lutetium versus cabazitaxel, and it was kind of provocative. The endpoints are sort of not particularly clinically meaningful. My sense is that this is a real therapy. Again, I don't think this is a home run, but I think it's going to, I would be a little surprised, frankly, based on how the trial was conducted. The control arm was the alternative Abby-Enza flipover. So I would hope that we'll see, real meaningful benefit from this therapy. Again, it's, as you pointed out earlier when we were talking about radium, this is going to be administered by our nuclear medicine colleagues. And we're going to, for those of our colleagues who practice in the community, you're going to have to figure out how to work together with your nuke med docs because, medical oncologists are going to have to oversee the care.
So a final comment from Chris. Curious where you think maybe this is going to land in the sequence of therapy metastatic disease. You think it might be given, say, before cabazitaxel, for example, in the CAR-D situation? And also, Chris, any comments on where PSMA imaging is going to lead to?
Two thoughts. One, I suspect, in all honesty, if the lutetium PSMA study is proven to be positive, we're up against modest control arm, it's going to probably replace radium. You don't have to worry about bone only versus other. The cabazitaxel study said it looked like it had more anti-cancer activity than cabazitaxel in the control, in the randomization phase 2, randomized phase 2 small study, but it looked like it had more anti-cancer benefit in a select patient population who had PSMA PET positive without discordant disease. So if you were PSMA PET positive in one lesion but FDG positive in another, you didn't go on the study. So there was some selection in that study. They had some selection in VISION, so that's something we'll have to work out, and it's a topic for another day. But I'm very encouraged, and if it does come in, I suspect we would probably end up using it in patients with soft tissue and bone disease where we would be otherwise using radium. The PSMA PET imaging, it basically, bottom line is, we can see more cancer spots with PSMA PET imaging, whether it be the gallium or the other versions of it. We just don't know how to use it, actually. And I've got two concerns. One is, if you get a PSMA PET in a patient who has high-risk localized disease, conventional scan negative, and they have some disease beyond the pelvic lymph nodes, do not abort the local therapy. Treat them as high-risk. They're the micrometastatic patients who may actually benefit from the long hormones and the radiation and be cured. Do not abort just because they have some PSMA positivity where we know they have a survival benefit. The other scenario where I've seen a problem, rising PSA prostatectomy, PSA gets to 0.2, someone sends them off for a PSMA PET and they say, you know what, let's wait until your scan is positive before we give you your curative salvage hormone and radiation. Don't do that. The higher your PSA, the lower your cure rate. They're my words of caution. But it sees more cancer.
So I want to thank the faculty so much for tonight, and thank you all for attending.